Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
A federal judge says Texas's foster care system is still broken, and she's charging a serious fine until it gets fixed. Today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm Michael Marks. The state will have to pay $100,000 per day because of foster care failures. We'll fill you in on the latest details. Plus, the cost of building a highway, and we're not just talking dollars and cents. A new book dives deep into the price of the open road for Texas cities. And the next generation of mechanics is getting ready to work on the next generation of cars. We'll look into the future of working on automobiles. We've also got the rest of the day's news as it breaks. It's the Texas Standard on a Wednesday, right after this. From Rosebud to Oak Leaf, Sour Lake to Flower Mound, you're tuned in to the Texas Standard on April the 17th, 2024. I'm Michael Marks. Much of the nation is understandably locked into the first ever criminal trial of a former president. Yesterday was day two of the trial of former President Donald Trump, who's accused of committing fraud to cover up an affair. The focus is on one man, how he'll react, will he stay awake, and what does it mean for the rest of us? We are going to leave that alone, however, and focus on a different court proceeding at the top of the show today. One that's closer to home, and which concerns the fate of thousands of anonymous children. You have heard this kind of story before, because in Texas, it's been a long, long time since the programs designed to protect our most vulnerable kids did anything approaching that, by and large. Since 2011, a series of judges have found serious deficiencies in Texas's child foster care system. State Health and Human Services officials have been ordered on multiple occasions to fix practices that endanger kids. The state's also been fined multiple times for failing to make those fixes. That happened again on Monday when District Court Judge Janice Jack decided to fine the state $100,000 a day until it can repair the way it investigates complaints by kids in its care. For more, we're now joined by Taylor Goldenstein, state politics reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Taylor, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Can you give us some examples of the kinds of failures that led Judge Jack to levy this fine?
Yeah, so the suit or the order goes through a number of examples. One of them was a 14-year-old girl who had pretty severe cognitive impairment. According to the suit, she was performing at a 2 to 4-year-old level, basically on separate occasions, she was allegedly tased, she was allegedly beaten, ran away from the facility, attempted suicide, was left at a hospital with her jaw broken, and there were, you know, a dozen investigations into those different situations that many of them took more than a year and a half or a year and a half to resolve. And the judge said that that is not within, you know, the expectations she set previously for the state to expedite these investigations and complete them in a timely manner to keep these children safe.
So are these concerns just about the fact that the investigations are being delayed, or is it also that the result of these investigations is keeping kids unsafe?
Right. It's kind of both. So, you know, the monitors, the people who the court have appointed to oversee how the state is doing on this process, they looked at cases that had an unconfirmed or inconclusive disposition. And in many of those situations, they found what they called serious deficiencies. And some of those, you know, reasonings for those dispositions were, in fact, the delays. You know, in some cases, an investigator, you know, may have taken so long on an investigation that the perpetrator, the alleged perpetrator, maybe no longer worked at the facility or, you know, couldn't be located.
Well, how does this compare to some of the other penalties that the foster care system has incurred?
Yeah, so this is the third time that the judge has issued fines, but it's the biggest fine that she's ever issued. And the last time was 2019. So at that time, she fined the state $50,000 a day. And that was over, you know, around the clock supervision through the night at kind of group foster care facilities.
Uh-huh.
This time, it's double that a day.
That's a lot of money. I wonder, what exactly does the state have to do to stop the fines, and when will they get a chance to prove that they've done so?
Right. So the order is going to stay in place until the state can certify to the judge that they, you know, they've looked over all their open investigations and are, you know, being what the judge considers substantially compliant with her order. And that covers, you know, cases over a long period of time. And they are going to need to provide data on all those cases, the ones that are open and closed. And then the monitors will need to review those and report their findings to the court.
What have representatives from the state, either the Attorney General's office or Health and Human Services, the two main agencies that are involved here, have you heard anything from them about this order?
Yes, so they're appealing, and that'll go to the Fifth Circuit. And they're also asking the lower court to pause the ruling while they wait on that ruling from the Fifth Circuit. But they essentially argue that they're doing as best they can and they're making a good faith effort to improve these situations. They also say that, you know, in some ways they feel that the judge is focusing on the wrong thing, as in, you know, focusing on a small subset of cases where they say, you know, they have thousands annually and they don't all go this way.
We've been speaking to Taylor Goldenstein. She covers state politics from the Austin Bureau of the Houston Chronicle. Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Four states restrict divorce during pregnancy, including Texas. And now, with a decision by the Arizona Supreme Court this week, it happens that all four of those states also have near total bans on abortion. That is a dangerous policy combination, according to experts on domestic violence. Here to tell us more is Jennifer Gerson, a reporter for the 19th News. Jennifer, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we are talking about Missouri, Arkansas, Arizona, and Texas here. First, can you tell us exactly how these states restrict divorce for someone who's pregnant?
Sure. So it varies a bit in this group, but with all of these states, with the exception of, I believe, Missouri, there is a policy where for most of them, you cannot finalize a divorce while someone is pregnant. So in Texas, how this works is that if someone is pregnant and they can file for divorce, but that divorce cannot be finalized and granted by a judge until a pregnant person gives birth. The law is written, you know, like legal experts in the state say, so that a judge cannot make an order on custody, things pertaining to child support, until that child is born, and the state can't rule in that way till then. But what domestic violence experts say is that this kind of can create a really tricky dynamic for survivors who are in a domestic violence situation, are pregnant, and are trying to find a safe way out.
Yeah, what does the data tell us about the risk for potential domestic violence victims during pregnancy and just after birth?
Sure. So a 2020 study found that just being pregnant or in the first year postpartum increases a person's risk of homicide by 35% compared to those of reproductive age who are not pregnant or postpartum. And 55% of those homicides occur in the home and are classified as domestic violence. So it's a really real situation that pregnant people are facing when it comes to this intersection between domestic violence, homicide, and pregnancy in the postpartum period. You know, intimate partner violence is a factor in 64% of all homicides of pregnant and postpartum people. This is a really real reality. Again, leading cause of death for pregnant and postpartum people, that peripartum period, pregnancy, that first year postpartum, is an incredibly sensitive time. Mm-hmm. And it's often a time that can trigger domestic violence, either that domestic violence starts or escalates during this period. And experts say it's because sometimes abusers feel like they're losing control over victims during this time too. And so concerned that a child entering the dynamic will either cause more stress or cause their victim to turn attention elsewhere. And that's why abuse often intensifies during this period.
I see. So how do abortion bans play into this equation?
So abortion bans, you know, experts say, you know, this is just kind of one more thing that sometimes can restrict a person's choices and agency. What I've heard from a lot of experts in this space is that, especially for someone in a domestic violence situation, they're facing a, you know, real and often life-threatening loss of autonomy, loss of control. And again, being pregnant can really intensify that. Without access to abortion for some of these people, this might mean staying in a situation that is more dangerous, to having a prolonged exposure to an abusive partner. Again, just kind of removing yet another mechanism that someone can use to keep themselves safe. And then, you know, the aspect of pregnancy or even trying to access abortion can be something that a partner might use to further exert control or abuse over someone, whether it's doing something like forbidding them to go to any OBGYN appointments unsupervised, or preventing them from accessing abortion in a state like Texas, like traveling out of state. So there's just so many dynamics at play, and making accessing abortion that much harder is just another kind of tool in the toolbox, experts are saying, for abusers now, knowing what the landscape is in so many of these states.
We've been speaking to Jennifer Gerson. She covers breaking news for the 19th News. We'll have a link to her reporting over on our website. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Wells Dunbar is keeping an eye on social media for us. Hey, Wells.
Hey, Michael, good to be with you. Well, hearing from lots of folks about the future of work in Texas, and that's no coincidence. We have that special broadcast coming up on Monday, delving into the topic and receiving some fascinating responses from folks out there on our Facebook page. Heidi Ajrami says she's a community college professor. I'm retiring in December after 25 years. I'm too tired to keep up with all the changing state regulations, the emphasis on technology, which students don't know how to use or don't have access to, and the lack of preparedness of students coming straight out of high school. Meanwhile, Todd Gernert says, I work remotely for clients not based in Texas. Several have said they'd never consider moving here because of policies enacted by Republican state leaders. And Britt Trente says, I'm a music therapist. I provide services to people on Medicaid waivers and receive reimbursement. I follow Medicaid issues closely because in this state, it seems they're all about creating more exceptions to coverage and attempting to reduce funding. Three of the dozens of responses we have received on this topic. I know we're going to have more about the future of work coming up at the end of the show, and I think I'll be back right around that time too with more responses from social media. Michael?
Yeah, we really want to hear from you about this. Tell us what you think about the future of work in Texas. Wells Dunbar will be back in 35 minutes.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, right here with cancer care at more than 280 locations around Texas, allowing patients to remain close to family, friends, and caregivers while they fight against cancer. More at texasoncology.com.
I'm Jason Mellard from the Center for Texas Music History at Texas State University. This week in Texas music history, we crown the queen of Austin's early country scene. On April 18, 1912, country band leader Dolores Ferris was born in Hutto, Texas. She spent most of her life in the Govalley area of Austin. Her musical career began as a piano player in her father's polka band, and it was in that role that she met her future husband and bandmate Lee in 1930. The two married the following year in San Marcos, and in the early 1940s, Dolores organized the country band Dolores and the Bluebonnet Boys with Lee on drums. They toured Central Texas, appeared on radio, and recorded several popular regional singles that Dolores had written or arranged, including Austin Waltz, I Don't Care, and A Broken Heart. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, Dolores and the Bluebonnet Boys became the house band for the Skyline Club in North Austin. This was a key spot on the Texas honky-tonk circuit that became infamous as the site of the final concerts of Hank Williams Sr. and Johnny Horton. More importantly, though, the Skyline also planted the seeds, night after night, of a Central Texas country sound that would continue to unfold in the years ahead. Ferris, for example, was a tremendous influence on yodeler and business owner Kenneth Threadgill, who said that Dolores did more to teach me about music than anybody, a favor that Threadgill would pass on in his mentorship of Janis Joplin and others at his bar on North Lamar, not far from the old Skyline. In one sense, then, Dolores Ferris set the stage for Kenneth Threadgill, and Threadgill used that stage to nurture the younger talents of Austin's folk and country scenes in the 1960s and 1970s, putting Austin on the musical map. And you can hear music from the Lone Star State 24/7 on the Texas Music Experience at tmx.fm. For the Texas Standard, I'm Jason Mellard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to protecting Texas employers by investigating fraud and focusing on preventing abuse of the system. More at texasmutual.com/fraud.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. In some cities in Texas, it's not against code to build a bedroom without a window. Over the past two decades, developers in Austin have built hundreds of windowless bedrooms. But now, some elected officials want them banned. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has the story.
Julia Mahavier is a senior at UT Austin. She lives in an apartment in West Campus in a small bedroom off a hallway.
I have four photos on my wall, a poster, a painting, and a poem from someone in Palestine, and a heart from Valentine's Day.
Standing in Mahavier's bedroom last week, I asked her to do me a favor. I asked her to turn off the lights.
Whoa, it is very dark in here.
It's pretty dark, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, like my eyes are adjusting, but I'm starting to, like, I can't quite see the bed anymore.
It was 11 a.m. on a sunny day, and I could barely see my own hand.
All right, do you mind turning that light back on?
Yeah, I know, I'm
going to go through. I'm gonna lose sense of time and place.
Mahavier's bedroom does not have a window. Well, she has this sliver of a window that looks out onto her hallway, but it barely lets in any light.
I did not know that windowless bedrooms were a thing in UT. It just never crossed my mind because I've never heard of that.
Mahavier tells me sleeping in a bedroom with no window to the outside world can be really jarring.
I'm waking up and it's completely pitch black. Besides having my clock, like looking over at the clock, I can tell what time it is, but I can't see what time it is. I don't know what the weather is. I don't know what it looks like outside.
Mahavier is likely one of thousands of UT students with a bedroom without windows. Since at least 2002, developers have been building windowless bedrooms in Austin, mostly in high-rise student housing west of the university. Having a window means having an exterior wall, but there are only so many exterior walls. So building rooms with no windows means you can cram more rooms into a building. More rooms, more profit. In fact, some buildings charge a monthly fee just for having a window. I reached out to about half a dozen developers who have built windowless bedrooms, but no one would talk to me.
My name is Juan Miró. I'm a professor at the School of Architecture of the University of Texas at Austin.
For decades, Miró has given his undergraduates an assignment: draw the window in their bedroom. A couple years ago, several students raised their hands and said they couldn't.
I had students that told me, I don't have a window in my bedroom. I say, what do you mean? This is impossible. That's illegal.
Nope, it's totally legal.
I have to tell them, just look for the closest window you can find and draw it. You know, not the one in your bedroom, but anywhere.
In 2022, Miró started writing op-eds about windowless bedrooms in Austin. He worked with students to write letters to city council asking for their help. Miró is originally from Spain. He's lived all over the world. He knew building a bedroom with no access to natural light is illegal in many places. Barcelona, Mexico City, New York. But not in Austin. Here's why. Austin, like many cities around the world, adopts what's called the International Building Code. It establishes rules for commercial buildings, which include apartments, mostly aimed at preventing fires. Part of the code deals with light in rooms where people sleep.
They say you need to have natural light according to this section, or artificial light according to this section.
The proposal Austin council members are scheduled to vote on tomorrow would change that or to an and, requiring some amount of natural light.
Thought your college dorm was bad? Check out this proposed windowless mega dorm at UC Santa Barbara.
In 2021, news broke that a wealthy donor to the University of California at Santa Barbara was using his money to design and build a new dorm. Nearly all the bedrooms would not have windows. There was a huge public outcry. A professor at the university quit, and the dorm never got built.
And I remember thinking to myself, my God, that's awful.
When Austin City Councilmember Zoe Kadri saw the news, he thought of his two younger sisters. Both have lived in windowless bedrooms as students at UT. One sister still does. Kadri says she sometimes asked to spend the night at his apartment.
Just so she could have a, you know, while she's studying, she just has a, you know, a place with a window. And I think it really does affect the mental well-being and the mental stress of the student.
Numerous studies support this. Natural light helps people feel more alert, less depressed, and regulates our circadian rhythm, the internal clock that gives us a sense of when it's time to sleep or wake up. Kadri's proposal would outlaw windowless bedrooms, with some exceptions. Developers will be able to build windows that let in, quote, borrowed light, meaning natural light that comes from another room. For example, a bedroom window that looks into a living room that has natural light. And to be clear, this new rule would not be retroactive. It will prevent new windowless bedrooms from being built. The existing ones will still be around.
Oh my God, the light. It's so different.
It's so nice. I love it so much.
Back in West Campus, Mahavir shows me her roommate's bedroom. There's a big window right next to the twin bed. And on this sunny day, the light is pouring in. Her roommate moved out a couple weeks ago, and typically, Mahavir says a property manager would lock that empty bedroom. But no one did. So she grabbed her stuff.
He literally just took my bedding and plopped it on here and my alarm clock, and that's it.
Mahavir's been sleeping in her former roommate's room for about a week. Just her bedding, her alarm clock, and yeah, a window. I'm Audrey McGlinchey in Austin.
Hey, you know what's so great about Wednesday? It's the day that the weekly Texas Standard newsletter lands in inboxes just once a week. We're not spamming you. We just want to send you some of our very best work, some thoughts from our staff, and a little preview of what's coming up for free. That's it. Go to newsletter.texasstandard.org. You're going to like it. You're going to like it a lot.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU Neely, hosting the Global Supply Chain Summit about AI, with a keynote address from Keurig Dr. Pepper, April 24th. More at tcu.edu/scsummit. Support for Texas Standard comes from Big Sun Solar, a local commercial solar company helping businesses, nonprofits, and municipalities across Texas achieve carbon reduction goals. More at BigSunSolar.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Alexandra Hart. Congress is working on legislation aimed at beefing up federal efforts to combat anti-Semitism. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider says the measure comes as anti-Semitism is surging both across Texas and nationwide.
The legislation, which is moving in both the House and Senate, would create a national coordinator of efforts to combat domestic anti-Semitism within the White House. Houston area Congressman Randy Weber co-chairs the House Task Force for Combating Anti-Semitism.
I think we all should agree on the fact that anti-Semitism is on the rise, and it cannot be left to go unabated.
The House and Senate bills would require the FBI, the Homeland Security Department, and the National Counterterrorism Center to produce a joint annual assessment of violent anti-Semitic extremism. They would strengthen efforts by the Department of Education to counter anti-Semitism at colleges and universities, and they would formally establish May as Jewish American Heritage Month in federal law. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
San Antonio Congressman Tony Gonzalez has amassed a considerable fundraising advantage over his Republican primary challenger, Brandon Herrera. Gonzalez faces Herrera in the May 28th primary runoffs for the District 23 seat that spans from San Antonio along the border to El Paso. Texas Public Radio's Dan Katz has more.
Gonzalez was censured by the Texas GOP last year for moderate votes on issues like gun control. That opened the door to a challenge from the far-right social media influencer known as the AK guy. Brandon Herrera has faced criticism for joking about the Holocaust and veteran suicide, among other things. In the first quarter of this year, Gonzalez raised over $949,000 to Herrera's $401,000. Both campaigns raised more money from out of state than in Texas. I'm Dan Katz in San Antonio.
The winner will face Democratic challenger Santos Limon in November. The Supreme Court has given unanimous approval for some property owners east of Houston to sue the state for flooding on their property. The case involves a road barrier that was erected during the widening of I-10 that trapped floodwaters from draining during Hurricane Harvey. The ruling allows the case to move forward in federal court. Shrimpers in Texas have struggled to stay afloat as imported shrimp floods the market, but a new bill hopes to steer U.S. taxes away from anything but domestic shrimp. Texas Public Radio's Gage Davila has more.
The bill aims to address international financial institutions funding non-U.S. shrimp farms using U.S. dollars. The surplus of shrimp hurts shrimping industries in Texas and across the Gulf Coast by bottoming out its value, meaning U.S. shrimpers cannot sell enough shrimp to cover the costs of harvesting them.
The bill has bipartisan support. I'm Alexandra Hart from the Texas Newsroom.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Aspire Allergy and Sinus, providing same-day results and custom treatment plans to tackle allergies at the root of the problem. Over 40 locations throughout Texas. More info at aspireallergy.com.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Michael Marks. The city of Denver sent two city employees to El Paso last week to deliver some news in person. The city is making changes to its immigration policy. Specifically, Denver is shifting away from emergency sheltering and focusing on long-term housing and job training. Those services will be useful to asylum seekers, but they'll be available to far fewer people. Desiree Mathurin is a neighborhood reporter for the Denverite and Colorado Public Radio, and she joins us now. Desiree, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What are the big differences between what Denver has been doing for asylum seekers and what they will be doing after the policy changes?
So the big difference is what you mentioned. The city is moving away from emergency sheltering and going into a focus on long-term housing. Prior to the change, long-term sheltering included, you know, a 3-week stay for families, or a 2-week stay for single people, and now that change is going back to typical congregate sheltering, which is about 24 to 72 hours. With the change, that means less people will be able to go into the sheltering system, and if they do go into the sheltering system, they'll be quickly funneled out of the system. So the change now is focused on long-term housing, which means, like you said, fewer people will be able to enter the program. The program has a cap of about 1,000 people, and most of the people will be those who are already in the shelter system, which is around 800 people. So there's about room for 200 more, and then after that, people will have to go back into congregate sheltering, which I mentioned is a shorter stay.
I understand. Well, why did these folks from Denver think they needed to go to El Paso to deliver this news in person?
So city officials said the reason why they traveled to El Paso to give the news out to folks, mainly to nonprofit leaders, is just to inform folks of what they're getting if they decide to come to Denver. The goal of the trip, according to city officials, was to let people know, hey, our policies are changing. There is no longer emergency sheltering. There's no longer extended stays of sheltering. So if you arrive in Denver and there's no space in the Denver Asylum Seeker Program, you will be put into congregate shelter, and that's a shorter stay. City officials said it wasn't necessarily to deter folks from coming to Denver. It was just to be really open and upfront about what folks will be receiving once they arrive in the city. And again, that's to make sure people know that instead of a 2-week or a 3-week stay, it would be a 24 to 72 hour stay in a congregate shelter.
People who you talk to, are they buying that line that this is not to deter people from coming, or do they maybe see that as part of the motive?
So one nonprofit we spoke with in El Paso said this is something he's been seeing frequently from bigger cities, especially in Chicago and New York. They'll send people down to help coordinate, but he does see it as a method of discouraging people, but ultimately it's not really going to discourage anyone from going where they want to go. He basically was saying that, and I can quote him, his name is Ruben Garcia, and he's the founder and executive director of Annunciation House, which is one of the largest shelters in El Paso.
Sure.
He said, you know, in the beginning, we were doing everything in our power to be as helpful as possible. And now we feel that all the resources that we were able to marshal are spent, and we're not sure how much we can offer you, which is basically what he feels like the city is saying to folks in El Paso. And he understands the tactic, but it's not going to stop folks from going where they want to go.
Right. You mentioned New York and Chicago. Those are locations that we've heard a lot about, you know, Governor Abbott, other governors busing immigrants to those cities. I haven't heard as much about Denver. I'm curious how many asylum seekers end up there generally.
The city of Denver has supported about 41,000 migrants, and they spent about more than $68 million on the effort. And that effort included, as I mentioned, the long-term sheltering, some work authorization visas and things like that. So about 41,000 newcomers have arrived in the city. And the city official and Denver city officials are saying about half of them continue to call Denver home. So there's still about, you know, 20,000 new immigrants here, and you know, they're becoming Denverites themselves.
Did you get the sense that city officials believe that this is stretching resources unreasonably, and that's why this change had to be made, or not so much?
Right. So if the city continued to shelter folks the way they were doing with the long-term sheltering plan, it would have cost the city an additional $180 million in 2024. With this new change to focus on long-term housing, workforce training, and essentially a six-month wait of hoping that folks can be able to get their work visas in that time, the city is going to spend about $68 million. It's a significant savings, of course, and that leads the city to no longer have to do big budget cuts across the board.
Desiree Mathrin is a reporter with the Denverite and Colorado Public Radio. We'll link to her work at texasstandard.org. Desiree, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, working towards a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm Michael Marks. In urban Texas, highways have been central to the way we move from place to place. Giant roadways bisect or loop around a city as commuters whiz down ribbons of concrete and steel at top speed. But some Texans are beginning to challenge long-held assumptions about highways, asking whether the destruction of neighborhoods required to build them and the segregation these projects intensify are worth the promised quicker commute. These activists even question a basic assumption about highways, that bigger roads reduce traffic congestion. In her book, City Limits, journalist Megan Kimball examines the effort to rethink urban highways in Texas. She also traces the history of racism and inequality that carved up communities in three of the state's largest cities. The Standard's Angela Kocherga asked Kimball why her book focuses on highways in Houston, Dallas, and Austin.
Well, I live in Austin. I live about a mile from I-35, which runs right through the heart of the city. So I started reporting the book in early 2020, when I heard about Texas Transportation Commission voting to allocate more than $4 billion to expand this highway. And as I started reporting on highway expansions across the state, I learned about the North Houston Highway Improvement Project, which locals call the I-45 Project, which I think is notable simply because of its scale and scope. It is a massive highway expansion. It's grown to be a nearly $10 billion project that will displace 1,200 people. Mm-hmm. 300 businesses, take about 450 acres of land. So it has an enormous impact on the city, and accordingly, there's a pretty robust opposition to that project. And then I went to Dallas to look into a campaign that's about a decade old to remove a stretch of highway called I-345 that bounds the eastern edge of downtown. And that was really compelling to me because that is ultimately the argument of the book, that we actually don't need a lot of these urban highways and that land could be put to much better use.
Well, yeah, I want to delve into a lot of those issues. But first, let's, you know, history is a big part of the story you tell, how urban highways came to be in Texas and around the country. And you also trace the ways this affected neighborhoods. Can you sketch out a bit of the history of I-45 in Houston and what happened to the neighborhoods around it when it was built?
Yeah, a lot of these highways were initially built through Black and Hispanic communities. This happened in the 1950s and 60s. The Voting Rights Act had not yet passed. And city planners very intentionally routed highways through red line neighborhoods, which means neighborhoods that were denied access to credit from the federal government a decade or two earlier, simply because they had populations of Black and Hispanic people in them. So in Houston, you know, I chronicle the construction of I-10, which goes straight through the middle of Fifth Ward, a historically Black neighborhood. And that highway took out three full city blocks. I talked to a woman, her name's Oneri Goodry, who lived in one of those homes, and her family was displaced to another neighborhood. And she was determined to graduate from Phyllis Wheatley High School, so she walked 3 miles back to school. So these highways had an enormous, like, disruptive impact on these communities. In addition to displacing people, you know, they cut them in half. They really severed and segregated cities across Texas and the country.
Mm. Well, and in recent years, the plan to expand I-45 and uproot hundreds of homes and businesses got unexpected pushback from Houston residents. What are the plans to expand the highway now, and how did the residents affect that?
Yeah, so this group called Stop Texas on I-45 started knocking on doors across the city to say, hey, do you know about this highway expansion that's either going to displace you or your neighbors? And a lot of people were appalled to hear about it. They didn't know it was coming. People who lived in the footprint of the expansion had no idea that it would impact them. And so some of those people filed a civil rights complaint with the federal government, alleging that the project violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act because it disproportionately impacted Black and Hispanic people. And as a result, FHWA, the Federal Highway Administration, paused that project for more than 2 years while it investigated these serious concerns. Meanwhile, Harris County actually sued TxDOT for sort of similar reasons, alleging that it had not listened to community concerns. And as a result of those two actions, you know, TxDOT came to the table and negotiated. It's currently under what's called a voluntary resolution agreement. So the expansion is moving forward, but under pretty strict surveillance by the community and by FHWA. You know, they have to do much more community outreach. There's more flood mitigation measures. They're building caps over the highway. So I would say, like, on the whole, the community got really important concessions from TxDOT because of this fight, you know, that wouldn't exist without this grassroots opposition.
Well, you mentioned Dallas, and in Dallas, there's an elevated section of I-345 that both divides South Dallas, whose residents are predominantly Black, from the rest of the city, but it also gives them access to the northern part of the city where the jobs are. Does I-345 get at the heart of the conflict between those who see highways as a barrier to communities and a necessary option for commuting to jobs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the fight over that highway is so complicated and interesting. That highway consumes a lot of land, more than 200 acres of land for a 1.4-mile stretch of highway is either impacted by that highway or directly under it. And that land could be put to better use. It could build affordable housing, get on the property tax rolls for the city of Dallas. But indeed, because we have built our cities around highways, a lot of people rely on it to get where they need to go. Highways have segregated cities, and as a result, a lot of people from South Dallas need to go to North Dallas to go to work. I think the argument of the book, though, is like the state of Texas is on track to spend $65 billion to widen highways across the state through their program called Texas Clear Lanes. You know, what if we spent that money differently? What if we invested in buses and trains and transit to get people where they're going by other means?
Well, let's get to the heart of all this, the traffic congestion on older highways. TxDOT and a lot of people who drive on crowded highways have said more lanes means smoother traffic flow, but not everyone sees it that way. Can you explain why?
Yeah, the reason why more lanes does not actually fix congestion is because of a phenomenon known as induced demand, which basically says when you add capacity to a highway, cars will fill up that capacity. And this phenomenon has been well understood since the 1960s. It was first documented by an economist in 1962, basically saying, as we've been adding car capacity, cars are filling up that capacity. The most famous example of induced demand is the Katy Freeway in Houston, which TxDOT expanded to one of the widest highways in the world at 26 lanes. And rush hour traffic is actually worse today than it was before that highway was expanded. And the basic reason is that, like, people drive more. They either move farther from their jobs and schools, you know, they move out to far-flung suburbs, predicated on speedy access on that highway, or they take more discretionary trips. And as a result, like, traffic measurably increases, even controlling for population. And that has been documented decade after decade after decade in city after city. And yet our transportation department is still kind of promising to fix congestion by widening highways.
So what do, how do we move people from place to place? And are there projects elsewhere around the country that Texas could learn from?
Yeah, the basic argument of the book is the better way to move people from place to place is through transit. It's much more efficient in an urban area. You know, I'm not talking about getting between Austin and Houston, for example. I'm talking about moving around within Austin or within Houston. And all the evidence shows it's like much more efficient to move people in buses or trains. And again, that has also been well understood since the 60s and 70s. Like, politicians from both parties were saying, hey, if we're really going to fix urban congestion, we need to invest in transit. And for various reasons, which I get into the book, that simply didn't happen. We spend about four times as much money on highways as we do on transit. For many reasons, and climate change among them, you know, we need to start spending some of our transportation money on transit. And there are great examples across the country. For example, Colorado, I just actually was there reporting a story for the New York Times. Their state DOT has decided to move a lot of its funding from highway widenings to transit, recognizing that if they want to meet their statewide greenhouse gas reduction goals, you know, they need to get people out of their cars. And so the state is investing in bus rapid transit in Denver to move people around. And like, we certainly could do that here in Texas. I think it's a good model for like a kind of car-centric city. How do you start to move away from that? It's like you build better transit systems.
Megan Kimball is the author of the new book, City Limits, Infrastructure, Inequality, and the Future of American Highways. Megan, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Michael Marks. Over the past few weeks, the Texas Standard team has been hard at work trying to answer one big question. What is the future of work going to look like in Texas? We're going to dedicate our show on Monday to some of the answers we've found. We'll also dive into the future of education, like how should we prepare students for the jobs of the future? With increased focus on student loan debt and the cost of college, outlets like Bloomberg and Business Insider are reporting enrollment at trade schools is on the rise. Today, we bring you the story of one Austin student who chose to enroll in an automotive program after watching a TikTok video.
My name is Ryan Beardsley. I'm 18. Currently, we're working on vehicles right now. We're looking at diagnostics of like ECT, throttle position sensor, looking at the voltage of everything, the resistance, trying to diagnose what the problem would be in certain vehicles. Yeah, we're over here. So like this, we're using a DMM to test our two test points here, and we're testing our power wire and then our ground wire. And we're seeing how much voltage is at it, and then we're testing the resistance of it. And then from there, we're using a scan tool and looking at the like the PID values on the scan tool to tell if they match up, because if they don't, then you know that you have a problem in the wiring, or if you have like a high resistance in the wiring.
Did you know a lot about cars before you got
in? Not really, honestly. Like, I'd worked with my dad a little bit before, but I learned a lot since I came here. Like, the density of the material, like, it's day after day you learn something new, basically. There's a lot of, like, intricate things that are different from vehicle to vehicle. Like, certain vehicles might not have a test point because they're manufactured differently, or the engine configuration can be different from vehicle to vehicle. So it makes it just a little bit different when you're learning how to like diagnose certain vehicles, where things might be or how easy they are to test them. So I actually was working at Walmart and I saw an ad on TikTok actually. And I kind of started doing my work there, and then I saw an ad on TikTok and I just like clicked on it, and it kind of just went from there. Like, I got a date to come view it, or UTI, like 2 days after, and then it kind of just happened from there. I want to go into an MSAT, so.
What is that?
It's manufacturer-specific training. Uh-huh.
So I would hope to go into like Volvo or Porsche. I don't know. I have the grades for it, so hopefully I can keep them up. This one, thank you.
That was Ryan Beardsley, an auto student at Universal Technical Institute in Austin. He's part of the increasing number of students enrolling in vocational programs over the past few years. A new report from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center says while bachelor's and associate's degree completion rates have declined, more students earned a certificate in the 22-23 academic year than in any of the last 10 years. The increase in certificate graduates also seems to match up with demand. In 2023, the Texas Workforce Commission reported that the labor category of trade, transportation, and utilities grew significantly, adding more than 7,000 jobs in the state. Listen for more Future of Work in Texas coverage this week, and then tune in for our special show on Monday. You can also find more right now at our website.
Support for Texas Standard's Future of Work in Texas comes from TalRu's Ready, Set, Hire. Serving Central Texas hiring needs, one employer and one job seeker at a time. Job search and recruiting tools available at ReadySetHire.com. And from Goodwill Central Texas, providing one-on-one career guidance, professional certifications, job placement assistance, and employer connections to Central Texans in need. Details at GoodwillCentralTexas.org.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our watcher on the wall when it comes to social media. Wells, what's up?
Hey, just putting in the work over here, Michael. What about you?
Yeah, about the same, man. It's been a busy one. There's a lot going on, but it's exciting.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely. And we are hearing from more folks about the topic at hand, the future of work at Texas. We've got been working hard on this special broadcast coming at you on Monday and hearing some really fascinating responses from our listeners about the changing work environment, how things have changed for them and where things might be headed. All the issues we're grappling with in that special broadcast next week. On our Facebook page, Jordan Peterson says, I used to travel far and wide across Texas when I started 11 years ago. But he notes that, yes, with the dramatic expansion of tools and information on the internet during that time, I rarely have to go anywhere anymore. It's made me much more productive, he says, but sometimes I do miss the road and all those small towns.
Sure.
I could imagine that, to be sure. Janelle Kirby Holt has an interesting perspective. They write that, I noticed the educational requirements keep going up. Well, it seems less folks entering the workforce are doing degrees, echoing some of what we just heard about the sort of rapid expansion we've seen in trades and folks pursuing
vocational programs.
Yeah, that form of education. Where I work, almost everyone has a master's degree, he says, and that wasn't the case 10 years ago. I also think a mixed blessing of the pandemic forced implementation and considered consideration for many employers to offer work from home and flexible work week operations. And of course, yeah, it's hard to overstate just how fundamentally COVID really did shift everything with that regard in terms of working from home and really that expansion of technology coming at a perfect time for that. Here's a nice aspirational message from Robert Flood on our Facebook page, who says, I retired a few years ago and started writing as a freelancer with the emphasis on free. Now, after a few years, I'm getting some pay for some writing assignments. I'm enjoying this after career job so much, and of course I can listen to public radio all day.
There you
what's
go.
What's not to like there? But yeah, fun employment, I've seen it referred to in some quarters. Folks that have opted out of the workforce and now can sort of re-enter it more on their own terms,
right, which, at their leisure.
Yeah, sounds like a nice thing.
Sounds
to
nice.
Be sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, right. Of course, many people echoing what we heard from another commenter earlier about the sort of impact of Texas political climate. Mm-hmm. Brent Burrow says he's a small business owner and he's had several hiring prospects decline offers based on the stated desire to stay out of the Texas political environment, not wishing to relocate to the state. And lastly, Deanne Meza says that she works in retail and everything, even there, is going AI. Talk about a rapid expansion of technology. It's just head spinning to see how many companies are racing to incorporate many of these artificial intelligence tools into their platforms, into their workflows. So again, all topics we're going to be exploring in that special Monday broadcast, The Future of Work in Texas.
You're going to want to tune in to that one. We are out of time, but the news never stops over at texasstandard.org. For everybody here on the Texas Standard team, I'm Michael Marks. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.
If you want to know what's going on in the world, then you need to know what's going on in Texas. Every weekday on the Texas Standard, we bring you stories from across the state that affect what's going on elsewhere. As part of the NPR Network, an independent coalition of public media podcasters, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Michael Marks. Talk to you tomorrow.